to start on a new series. And we're going to be looking at the book of Proverbs, and I'm delighted to say that we have notes for theology students in the porch for both Proverbs and Philippians. A double whammy this morning. So if you're a theology student and would like to read a bit about the theological background that's gone into preparation for the studies, please take the notes in the porch. Also, if you would prefer, they are available free online as a PDF download from our website. Proverbs on the bench or in the starting lineup, the theology of the book of Proverbs. And Philippians, that article is called Philippians and the New Pauline Perspective. And if you don't know what that means and want to find out, well, take the notes. And if you do know what it means and want to argue with me, that's great as well. So please, if you're a theology student or just an interested amateur, please do take and read the notes. Okay, let's go to the book of Proverbs. The general sort of introduction this morning, but we'll be looking specifically at some of the verses in chapter 1. So let's take a look at how this book begins, because it begins this way for a purpose. It's meant to lead us in to the wisdom of God. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. For attaining wisdom and discipline, for understanding words of insight, for acquiring a disciplined and prudent life, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance. For understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. Listen, my son, to your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. They will be like a garland to grace your head, and a chain to adorn your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, do not give in to them. If they say, come along with us, let's lie in wait for someone's blood, let's waylay some harmless soul, let's swallow them alive like the grave and whole like those who go down to the pit, we will get all sorts of valuable things and fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot with us and we will share a common purse. My son, do not go along with them. Do not set foot on their paths, for their feet rush into sin. They are swift to shed blood. How useless to spread their nets in full view of the birds. These men lie in wait for their own blood. They waylay only themselves. Such is the end of all who go after ill-gotten gain. It takes away the lives of those who get it. Years after copper began to be mined on the Great Orme down there in Llandudno, when that industry was 500 years old, in the Middle East, in the land we know today as Iraq, God called a family. And that family migrated to what we know as the Promised Land. And that family became a tribe, and 500 years later, that tribe became a small nation. And we saw a couple of years ago, as we looked through the book of Deuteronomy, the blueprint for that nation. It was to be a nation where there were no poor. No one was to be poor in that country. Everyone had rights. There was to be sustainable development, good public health, a sensible foreign policy, and it was a place where asylum seekers were to be welcomed and treated with respect. And some hundreds of years after that blueprint was laid down, it looked for a moment as if Solomon, the king, was going to pull all that together. There was growth and prosperity, a flowering of culture. There was peace with the nations around about. There was time to think. There was time to reflect. There was time to publish books and read them. And yet, at street level, it was a mess. Businesses were fiddling their customers. Children were running amok. People refusing to work. There were still the poor around. Families were breaking up. People were binge drinking. The blueprint for the nation had foundered on the old rock of human nature. No matter what the plan, the human race seems to have a way of bringing it down to nothing. How do you make God's plans work on the small scale? It's all very well to have a great blueprint, but how do you make it work at street level? And so we get the book of Proverbs. In a moment I thought I'd call it Religion for Dummies. I quite like that. But I haven't found any other commentator that's dared call it that, so I'm probably wrong. Derek Kidner puts it better. It puts godliness in working clothes. It puts godliness in working clothes. That's a lot better, isn't it? So what every child should know about how to survive life. We're blessed, as everyone is, we are so blessed with students, and it's just great to have them with us for 3 years, and then they leave. And we got used to that. It's sad, but they go, and they go on to all sorts of places, all new jobs all around the world. And some of them keep in touch. Most don't. That's fine. You've got to move on, and most think they've moved on. That's fine. Some keep in touch. And that's nice when that happens. And some years ago, one of the girl students, an absolutely brilliant student, she wrote me a little card after she'd left. And she thanked me and the church for the blessing we had been in her life. And that was so good to know. It's absolutely wonderful to know that all this is worthwhile. And she said something that shocked me, that just, it had never been said to me before, it's never been said since. But she said, "Peter, you're a good man." And my first thought was, how little you know me. Really, you can't know me at all. But my second thought, straight on the back of that thought, came another thought. But my word, I'd like to be. I don't want to be remembered as a good father of two children who've grown up into responsible, wonderful young adults. I don't want to be remembered as a good husband. I don't want to be remembered as a church planter who planted all sorts of churches, as an author who's written books, as an academic who's published papers. That's all very well, but that's not actually how I want to be remembered. If I could choose how to be remembered, I would love to be remembered as a good man and to be worthy of the title. What a wonderful thing to aim for. And it struck me as I was thinking this through, because you understand, this card really caught me off balance. I began to think, and I thought, you know, that almost goes against my evangelical background, because after I came to Christ, I moved into quite a conservative evangelical background. I'm styled as a conservative evangelical, but that background did concentrate on turning you into a good man or a good woman. The pressure was on to get your doctrine right first. Didn't matter so much if you were good or not, as long as you had the right doctrine. That was the first thing. The idea is, once you got your doctrine right, everything else would follow. Nowadays, I call that wishful thinking. And the stress, the pressure was on you to be a soul winner. It's an old term. You can tell what decade I became a Christian in. there's no pressure on you to be a good man or a good woman, a good person. Wasn't on the agenda somehow. I wish I'd discovered Proverbs then. It might have changed my theology, my way of living. I might have been a better person now if I'd discovered this book earlier. Derek Kidner says, this book is to introduce the reader to a style of teaching that provokes their thoughts, getting under their skins by thrusts of wit, paradox, common sense, and teasing symbolism in preference to the preacher's tactic of frontal assault. Bill Hybels, in his commentary on Proverbs, in his sermons, talks about a member of his church, a highly successful businessman who built up a business that was flourishing and growing. And Bill said to him, what's your biggest problem? And he said, I've really got one problem. Bill, I've got one problem. I cannot find wise people to employ. They just don't seem to have common sense. Einstein said, there are two things without end, the universe and the stupidity of the human race, and I'm not sure about the universe. And there was a bumper sticker that said, artificial intelligence is no match for natural stupidity. So, God sets out his stall. Wisdom sets out her stall in verses 1 to 7. We have those on the screen. What's going on here? We have wisdom setting out her stall. For instruction and training in attaining wisdom and discipline. This is boot camp for the character. It's a tough regime meant to deal with our natural stupidity, our natural waywardness. Whether we're stuck in the house or the office, on the road or in the classroom, in a wheelchair or on a surfboard, this is boot camp for the soul. Aiming to give us understanding and insights. Now let me give you two examples of wisdom. There is a kind of secular wisdom, a cleverness that was common in the ancient world. And this is a story of a man who had three problems. His first problem was he had an empty wallet. He had no money. His second problem was that he had no children, and his wife was in a terrible state because she couldn't have children and was crying all the time. And his third problem was that he was an only child and his mother was dying. And so he was torn with his three problems: empty wallet, barren wife, dying mother, and he's an only child. What's he going to do? And he goes to bed worried and preoccupied. And in the night, God appears to him in a dream. And God says, I've heard your prayer, and I'm going to grant you one wish. Which is all right, but he's got three problems. And he's only got one wish, only one prayer to be answered. So what's he going to do? So he's obviously a lot more with it in his dreams than I am in mine, because he masters his thoughts together in his dream. And he says, well, God, if I'm only to have one wish, this is my wish. My wish is that my mother would live to see her daughter-in-law rocking her grandchild in a golden cradle. And that's kind of ancient wisdom. But there's another ancient wisdom that is altogether more profound. And if we go to the book of Kings, 1 Kings 3:9, Solomon goes to sleep. And in a dream, God appears to him. And he says, Solomon, what is your wish? What is your prayer? And Solomon's prayer is very different to that man in the story. So Solomon's prayer is this: Lord, give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong, For who is able to govern this great people of yours? He doesn't ask for wealth, doesn't ask for release from his enemies, doesn't ask for a peaceful life. He asks for a discerning heart. He prays for wisdom. And you know the story. God is so delighted. God says, I'll give you wisdom, Solomon, but I'll give you everything else as well. And he does. And you know the story. Solomon wakes up and these two prostitutes come to him with a child, and with the story that in the night they both have children. One rolls over and smothers her child accidentally and steals the live child from the other woman. And they come with the one child. Which child is which mother does this child belong to? And you know what Solomon does. He calls a soldier, says, get your sword, cut the child in half, give half to one mother, half to the other. And the mother whose child has died sort of shrugs her shoulders. The other woman screams and says, don't do that to my child, give it to the other woman. And someone said, this is the real mother. And everyone says, whoa, this man is a wise dude, you know. And but do you see the difference? In Solomon's prayer, he touches on God's wisdom. It's not the clever answer. It's the good heart. It's the discerning heart. It's the spiritual discernment that he's asking for and that God gives him. If you go back then to verses 1 to 7, wise dealing in verses 3 and prudent behavior, good sense and practical wisdom. In verse 4, it's about shrewdness and it's about discretion. It's about knowing your way around the system, being worldly wise. Jesus put it another way. He said, be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. Same sort of thing. But chapter 22, verse 3 says this. The prudent see danger and take refuge, but the simple keep going and pay the penalty. It's prudent to think ahead, to spot the danger. I've told you before, I'll tell you again, it's spiritual to have a plan B. And there's some who say, we'll go ahead in faith, this is the only option we've got. I say that isn't spiritual. The prudent sees danger, take refuge. The prudent have a plan B up their sleeve. Sometimes a plan C is good as well. We walk by faith. But having a plan B is also walking by faith. It's prudence. It's discernment. It's wisdom. It's seeing the danger and being prepared for it. And back to chapter 1, verses 1 to 7. It ends with this. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. We'll be looking next week at the fear of the Lord. What does that mean? How does that work out in 21st century Britain? At the root of it is God. You have to be wise to be good, but you have to be godly to be wise. It's the fear of the Lord which makes you wise, and it's wisdom that turns you into a good human being. The unwise will often turn against God. Fools despise wisdom and discipline. Chapter 19, verse 3. A man's own folly ruins his life, yet his heart rages against the Lord. Now, how many times have you seen that? Many, many, many years ago, several decades ago, somebody asked to see me. A young man who came to see me to complain that God was not blessing him. He could not understand why God wasn't blessing him. He was really angry. He was a graduate. And he should have been wealthy and well established by now, but he wasn't. And then he told me a story. Some years before, a decade before, he'd been driving his car on a rural road, been driving too fast at dusk, and suffered a horrendous accident, and his wife had been killed. And that somehow was God's fault, though he was at the wheel. He'd since remarried. and was very happy. But at the time that his wife died, he and his father had bought a large farm, piece of farmland. And they were planting soya. Now, this is in Mato Grosso in Brazil, the world's richest, most prosperous soya-growing area. It is the most fertile soya land in the world. A crop failure in Mato Grosso is equivalent to a good harvest in the United States. They work on that profit level. Some of the richest people in the world are planting soya in that part. It's beautiful soya land. The climate's good. The soil is good. And he and his father were making good money. But then they decided they would make even more money if they had their own machine for drying and packaging, sacking the soya. So they took out a very, very large bank loan to buy their own machine. And that year, exceptionally, the weather was appalling. They lost their harvest, and they were so deep in debt because of this machine, the bank pulled the plug on their credit line, and they went bust. The person who bought their farm became fabulously wealthy, but they lost everything. And this apparently was God's fault as well. And the whole conversation went like that, a series of mishaps that was all God's fault. He was furious at God. But this verse says, a man's own folly ruins his life, yet his heart rages against the Lord. It was his own fault, all of it. But he still blamed God. That is so typical of the human race. And if we go on to verses 10 to 16, for instruction, wisdom doesn't go to the palace. Here she goes down to the ghetto, to the gangland, to the seedy club. She goes to the gangs of inner city Manchester or New York or London. I was going to say Carnarvon, but that's stretching it a bit far, isn't it? And looks at gang members planning a robbery. And, you know, wisdom says really what's happening is these people are setting a trap for themselves. They are destroying their souls. Instead of learning from wisdom and growing, they are destroying their souls. They are hurting themselves. Compared to the simple rewards of wisdom, and as we shall see, hard work later on, the quick buck is irresistible, but with it comes a mighty elephant trap that you're about to fall into. Later on in the book, in chapter 17, verse 1, it has another of the proverbs. An odd one is, from better a dry crust with peace and quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. Better a dry crust with peace and quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. Wisdom settles you. Wisdom gives you discernment to organize your life, to work things out so that you are not overtaken by the chaos of an unwise life. And I was trying to think, well, how on earth am I going to explain this? And I came across an article in the Times in June, and it rang a bell with me, so I just want to compare two people. Both of these people came into a huge amount of money. Both of these people came into a fortune. The difference is one was a very devout Christian and the other is definitely not. And this is what the article in the Times said. Sandwiched on the court list between a driving while disqualified and a drunk in charge of a vehicle, Michael Andrew Carroll needed no introduction when he arrived in the dock. A regular before Kingsland magistrates for the offences such as disorderly behaviour and taking vehicles, Carroll is infamous in the tabloid press as the King of Chavs after winning £9.7 million on National Lottery. As he became the richest man to be given an ASBO yesterday, the 22-year-old was proof that money does not change anything. Since he won the jackpot 2.5 years ago, wearing an electronic tag, Carroll, who drives a Jeep with the number plate L11 out, read Lout, has bought 80 cars, several mansions, invested £1 million in Rangers Football Club, built a banger racing track and changed his tag for solid gold bling jewellery. He's been in and out of court, been deserted by his wife and child, had a spell in prison for failing to comply with a drugs treatment order and turned the lives of his neighbours in Swaffham, Norfolk into a nightmare. And the article, to be fair, tries to rehabilitate him a bit. So he's not that bad, really. It's more his friend he hangs out with and portrays him as a quiet, lazy, thoughtful man, it says. And does its best to rehabilitate him at least a bit. Recently, it says, convicted of cocaine possession. It is claimed he has only £500,000 left. That's one man. Now, here, let me tell you about another man. This man was known as Charles. This was Charles Thomas Studd, born in 1860 in Northampton. He died in 1931 in the Belgian Congo. He married Priscilla, and they had four daughters: Grace, Dorothy, Edith, and Pauline, and two sons, Pauline, and two sons who died in infancy. He was an international cricketer. He played for England in the famous 1882 match won by Australia, which was the origin of the Ashes. He became, with his wife, a Protestant missionary to China. He was part of what was known as the Cambridge Seven. And later moved to Africa, set up the Heart of Africa mission, which is now known as WEC International, World Evangelization Crusade. His father was fabulously wealthy. And while Studd was in China with his wife, his father died. And Studd came into an inheritance of £29,000. This was in the days when a labourer would be lucky to earn £15 a year. Okay, put it into that perspective. He came into a fortune of £29,000. While they were in China, he and his wife sat down and very carefully and thoughtfully gave orders to give £5,000 to the Moody Bible Institute, £5,000 for George Muller's mission work and his orphans, £5,000 for George Holland's work with England's poor, and £5,000 to the Salvation Army. And the rest they gave away to other charities. And they gave away the entire fortune. He's famous as writing, "Some want to live within the sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell." And he became a great missionary. And the churches that are currently growing and prospering in China and in Africa owe a massive debt to Studd and his generation, in which he was an inspirational leader and an example. "Better a dry crust with peace and quiet than a house full of feasting with strife," says Proverbs. Get your priorities right. Two men, two fortunes. One, a disaster. The other changed history for the better. The difference between them? Wisdom. Wisdom from on high. God's wisdom. And where does wisdom come from? Let's take a look at 1 Corinthians 1, 20 to 25 to begin with. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God, and what? The wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. Do you think they didn't call Charles Studd a fool when he gave away his fortune? Can you imagine the things they said about him in the coffee houses and the clubs of the expat community? Can you imagine how foolish they called him? 150 years on, tell me, was he foolish or was he wise? And that wisdom comes from Christ, the wisdom of God. The book of Proverbs comes from Christ, the wisdom of God. In the pages of this book, we find what a Jesus follower is like. This is the detail. This is Christianity for dummies. This is how the Christian faith dresses itself in working clothes and sets out to be wise in a society that does not value the wisdom of God. This is wisdom in a foolish world. This is the wisdom of God against our natural stupidity. And in coming weeks, as we look at different areas of our lives, we're going to discover what it means, what it is to be wise, and how to be wise, and how to live wisely. How, in other words, to be good people. If the band would just join me on the platform, please. Let's bow our heads and pray. This is Rob Lacey's take. This is for getting wise and for getting trained. This is his translation. For knowing what's what. For getting to grip with the deeper things. For a life kept in control and going somewhere. For doing the right thing, fairly and squarely. For giving common sense to the uneducated. For helping the young know what's right and helping them to buy into it. Let the wise guys learn and learn some more. Let the enlightened watch the lights come on. As sayings, illustrations, allegories and riddles do the rounds. Father, we're not very wise at times. All of us have a long memory of foolishness which we have committed. We have done some stupid things. And we have not been wise. But here, Lord, is our prayer. Make us wise. Make us good. Make us good people. Make us trustworthy people. Calm us and settle us. Give us peace and health. Give us wise decisions and good counsel. Make us trustworthy, confident, assured. Give us good plan A's and sensible plan B's. Make us followers of Christ, the wisdom of God. We ask often for the love of Christ to be seen in us. Well, Father, as we dive into this, your word, may the wisdom of Christ be seen in us as well. For this is the prayer of your people. In Jesus' name. Amen.